I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been a major crack in the security of the Green Zone in Baghdad, where a bomb exploded inside the Iraqi parliament today. The U.S. military says at least 8 people died, including 2 lawmakers, and 10 others were wounded when the bomb went off inside the parliament cafeteria. The explosion came hours after a suicide truck bomb blew up a major bridge in Baghdad that connects Shia and Sunni neighborhoods. Well, joining us with more is Baghdad bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers, Layla Fidel. Layla, you've spoken to lawmakers who were in parliament at the time of this explosion. What do they tell you?
Well, I spoke to some. They said that basically the explosion came out of the kitchen at the time and wounded a few people. There were 30 to 40 people sitting in this cafeteria where legislators typically will take their break and have lunch and then go back to session. They had broken up into different committees, and at that point the explosion occurred, and there was basically chaos, dust everywhere. Mithala Lucy said he saw a man lose his arm, but in the end it could have been much worse if it had gone off at a time where there were more parliament members having lunch, or if it had gone off in the hall where they actually meet.
Layla, there have been breaches of security in the Green Zone before. We remember a rocket attack last month killed 2 Americans, and we remember the rocket attack that came within yards of a building where the UN Secretary General was holding a news conference, and he ducked, you know, behind the podium. But what is the significance of today's attack to you?
Well, the difference here is that what is being said by the police that we've spoken to is that a suicide bomber walked into this building and detonated. This is supposed to be the most secure area of Baghdad. There are checkpoints everywhere. There are searches where you have a body search as well as your bags are searched. They go through x-ray machines, and somehow this person walked into an area where very important lawmakers are sitting and having lunch and was able to detonate. It also comes at a time where Baghdad is supposed to be more secure, and yet there have been 3 attempts on high-level politicians' lives. And now this is a pretty huge statement that somebody can walk into a secure building and detonate themselves in the middle of a bunch of legislators. There was also 2 suicide vest bombs found, I believe, at the beginning of this month in a dumpster inside the Green Zone. And so it seems that the attacks currently are more spectacular. They're more statement.
And obviously insiders perhaps have breached the security there. Well, maybe a bigger impact on the people of Baghdad outside the Green Zone is the attack on this bridge. We know the explosion caused the steel structure to collapse. Cars spilled into the Tigris River. 10 people have died. Tell us the significance of this bridge.
Well, it's a bridge that's been around since the beginning of the 1900s, built by the British. It's a place where a lot of Iraqis remember as somewhere they would walk from one side of Baghdad to the other, where they would jump off the bridge and go swimming under it as kids, where Iraqi soldiers and Iraqi police who had graduated from their academies would jump off it celebratorily and people would take pictures. And now that's a part of Baghdad that's gone, as so many important symbols of Iraq have been destroyed here. Another part of it that's very interesting that a lot of people are saying is that it's a conspiracy to separate Baghdad into 2 pieces. The east side of the bank is considered the more Shia majority of Baghdad, and the west side of the bank is considered the Sunni majority of Baghdad. The more contested neighborhoods are on the west side of the river, where neighborhoods are quickly separating. The army has cleansed Sunnis from their neighborhoods, where they consider those neighbors insurgents or insurgent-connected, and so neighborhoods are becoming more homogeneous. And so many people are saying, well, this is just another way to divide Baghdad, another way to separate us.
And we know there have been unconfirmed reports that this is a plan by the insurgents to blow up the city's bridges.
Yes, there have been unconfirmed reports that Al-Qaeda has been threatening to blow up the bridges and paralyze the capital, but the bombing is still unclaimed as far as we can tell. We've been looking at the sites where typically they post their claims, and both of the bombings of today have so far not been claimed.
If it was a bridge that was treasured by Iraqis, both Sunni and Shia, and had these wonderful memories, does that tell you necessarily that it was outside forces, perhaps foreign fighters, or not?
I don't think at this point it's really difficult to tell, because there's so much animosity now between the Sunni insurgent groups and the Shia militias. Shias feel completely victimized by Sunni insurgents and Al-Qaeda. They feel that they've been dying now for 4 years of this war in huge bombings where hundreds of them are being killed. The Sunnis feel targeted by a Shia majority that is, in their eyes, trying to push them out of Baghdad, where once they really ruled. They were the educated population. They were the population here in Baghdad, and the Shias were mostly from the south. But they're also still, of course, in Baghdad. And so there's so much animosity between these two groups. It's unclear whether it's coming from foreign fighters or anywhere else. The legislators today accused, mentioned that the bombing in the parliament may have been Al-Qaeda connected, that they had information that Al-Qaeda wanted to hit them and hit them hard inside the Green Zone and inside the convention center, specifically where they meet. But at this point, it's hard to tell if this was a foreign fighter or not.
Leila Fadel is Baghdad bureau chief for Meklati newspapers. She's been speaking to us today about two major explosions in Baghdad, one an historic bridge, the other inside the Iraqi parliament. Leila mentioned a lawmaker, Mithal al-Alusi, who said he saw a colleague lose an arm in that explosion. I've been told we have him now on the line. Mithal al-Alusi is an independent parliament member, secretary general of the Iraqi Nation Party. Mr. al-Alusi, you were there when the bomb exploded. What did you see?
Ma'am, what I have seen, a huge explosion. The air was really like smoke. You cannot see anything. Very dusty. That was really bad. But also, at the same time, we were so lucky because this is the lunchtime for the members. Usually, the area is really fully busy with the members. Today, we were so lucky, not all of us, we were there.
Sir, did you see people injured or killed? I mean, could you tell how harmful the bomb was?
Yes. We have lost some people, and others, they were wounded. This is really true, but also, I must say it, in the same second, in the same minute, we have talked, and our decision was clear. We are willing to continue the democratic process, and we will never let the terrorists winning the game. Our message is clear. We will meet and need to push in the democratic direction, and we will never give up. Those terrorists, they must understand, Al-Qaeda and the others, the Iranian intelligence, the Syrian intelligence, and the others. Nobody can control Iraq. We are willing to fight for our country, for our human beings, for the standard of the democratic, and for the standard of and the value of the human rights.
Well, Mr. al-Alusi, we understand the president of the parliament has called for an emergency session tomorrow. He's demanding that all members of parliament attend. Will you show up? Do you think your fellow lawmakers will show up?
No. We will be there. Nothing will stop us. I'm really serious. Let me tell you something. We have been informed from the security that we might accept a terrorist attack in the building. We know that, but nobody was hiding. We went to the meeting, to the parliament, and we're still doing that. Nobody can stop the democratic process in Iraq. And please, to the American politician, some of you, my colleague, we are learning from you the democratic process. We are learning from you the Constitution, and we are proud to be your partner and your friends. You have done a huge and great job in Iraq. We are so thankful for every family, American family, and for everybody. Please, we have to stay together to stop those terrorists. They will never stop from alone.
Well, Mr. al-Alusi, it sounds as if you are making a plea in light of what American polls show is a doubt on the part of Americans that the mission is going well in Iraq, and that lawmakers such as yourself haven't stepped up to stop this kind of violence. Now, I know that's a terrible thing, perhaps, for you to hear, as you saw your colleagues injured and perhaps killed today. But what do you say to Americans who say you have to stop this violence?
Madam, I have seen my sons, my only two sons, as they have been killed from the terrorists. If you can't stop the terrorists to attack New York, I will fully agree with you. If you can't stop the terrorists to attack Europe, I will be fully agree with you. The terrorists, this international network, they have a huge support from the Iranian, Syrian intelligence and finance support. Everybody has to understand, this is not just an Iraqi issue. This is an international fighting against the international terrorists, and we Iraqi, we stay in the course. We are not going to give up to let those terrorists controlling Iraq and Middle East. We must understand, if the terrorists, they can win the game in Iraq, there is no peace in the Middle East. There is no Israel in the Middle East. There is no democratic process in the Middle East. There is no human rights in the Middle East, but also not even your country will be safety from Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. So either we stay together to fight, or when you give up, you cannot guarantee your people that they will be safe.
Mital al-Lusi is the Secretary General of the Iraqi Nation Party. It's an independent party. He is a member of parliament. He was there when a bomb exploded today in parliament. And Mr. al-Lusi, I just want to be clear. You feel it was a bomb and not a suicide bomber?
Yes, that's what I feel it, that was a bomb. Anyway, Al-Qaeda, they are trying to say that they can stop us to think free, to be free, to be a human right, to be a human being, and to believe in peace. They cannot stop us. The message was clear from our Iraqi parliament, all of the members. We are going to continue. They cannot stop us.
Mr. al-Lusi, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Leila Fadel, a Baghdad bureau chief from McClatchy Newspapers. Obviously, we just heard this passion from a lawmaker that he will not be turned back in his efforts because of today's bombing. Are you hearing that from other lawmakers as well, or do you think some will stop showing up for work?
Well, Mikhail al-Lusi is a lone voice in some ways in his open and undeniable way that he wants cooperation with the United States. Most Iraqi legislators don't typically say publicly how thankful they are to the American troops. A lot of the times they criticize. I don't know if people are going to continue to show up because much of the parliament is actually outside the country, and you have the Sadrists already threatening to withdraw from the government. You have rumors that the Iraqi Accord Front, which is a Sunni group, threatening to withdraw from the parliament prior to this breach of security, and some lawmakers saying that this is a sign of the failure of this Baghdad security plan 2 months in, and they do the largest breach of the Green Zone. So it's unclear whether or not they'll continue, but there was a defiant call by Mahmoud al-Mashhadani, who was also attacked last month himself, to come to the parliament and to continue this process.
Well, we'll see what happens. Leila Fadel, Baghdad bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers, speaking to us from Baghdad after today's major explosions, one inside the Green Zone at the Iraqi parliament, as we've been saying, the other that destroyed an historic bridge. Leila, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, before we take our break, we wanted to make an appreciative nod to author Kurt Vonnegut, who died last night in Manhattan and right now seemed appropriate. Here he is speaking just months before the invasion of Iraq about how he and other anti-war voices, like Howard Zinn, participated in World War II. Vonnegut was captured by the Germans during the Battle of the Bulge.
Howard Zinn was a bombardier, and I was the bombed in the Second World War, and we were honored to be there. And yes, there are times when America should be ready to take casualties, but the number of civilians we kill is never commented on. And of course, that's a nasty thing for a country to do.
Kurt Vonnegut wrote such classics as Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle, A Man Without a Country, Like Shaking Hands with God, A Conversation About Writing, a personal favorite. He died last night at 84. We'll be back after a brief break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, there's a good chance no one got to work on time today in Japan, and it probably wasn't because they were following the speech of the visiting Chinese premier. At morning rush hour Japanese time, Red Sox pitcher Daisuke Matsusaka was facing Seattle Mariners uber hitter Ichiro Suzuki last night at Fenway Park. For the record, Daisuke did strike Ichiro out once, but the Sox lost 3-0. Well, with Daisuke's much-anticipated appearance behind them, the Japanese can now turn their attention to a bit of diplomatic history today. The first speech by a Chinese prime minister to the Japanese parliament in more than 20 years, as the two Asian powers try to mend fences and bolster business relations. In his speech, Wen Jiabao urged Japan's parliament not to forget their country's wartime aggression, and that's a touchy subject. The two powers have long been at odds over Japan's brutal invasions and occupation of China in the 30s and 40s. But what if this attempt at forging a friendship takes? What would a China-Japan alliance mean? John Bussey is editor for The Wall Street Journal Asia. He joins us from Hong Kong. And John, put this visit into context for us. What is this about?
This is really all about business and trade. And it goes to show that the old adage that two countries that trade together will do their best to get along. Trade between Japan and China has doubled in just the last 4 years. For Japan, China is the biggest trading partner. For China, Japan is the third largest trading partner, right after the EU and after the United States. So they have an enormous amount at stake, and it's very important. I think they both have decided to get along.
Well, we know that prior to the meeting, they issued a joint statement saying that China and Japan agreed to look at history frankly and jointly build a beautiful future. But one of the challenges, for instance, which just illustrates the problems, is the question of whether or not Prime Minister Abe from Japan made visits to the Yasukuni Shrine. Now tell us what the debate is over that.
Well, the Yasukuni Shrine is this very serene shrine in the middle of Tokyo. I don't know whether you've ever been there. It's really kind of a gorgeous walk up to the shrine, and it's a very creepy place once you get in, because it pays homage not just to Japan's war dead, but to some particular individuals who have been classified as Class A war criminals. And the Chinese are upset about this. The previous prime minister of Japan made a very sort of public showing of going to the Yasukuni Shrine. This is Junichiro Koizumi. Mm-hmm. He was really his own man, quite a maverick prime minister of Japan, quite a successful one who did a great deal for the country and was not going to be cowed by the concerns of the Chinese. Abe, on the other hand, has made a point of playing that down. A couple of weeks after he became prime minister in the fall, he made a trip to China. And he's basically said to China, hey, even if I were to go to the Yasukuni Shrine, I won't do it in public.
And for its part, China has said that it will tone down anti-Japanese content on television. And recently, when Prime Minister Abe denied that the Japanese military coerced women into sex slavery during World War II, which is a huge issue between the two countries, that kind of denial, you know, would have, you know, caused an outrage in China, but it seemed like the response was a little more muted. Are we reading that correctly?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that Wen Jiabao, China in general, is trying to be more friendly with Abe, and that's in stark contrast with the previous prime minister. They want to make headway on trade relations between the two countries.
And tell us more about that. What does China want from Japan? What does Japan need from China?
Japan wants the domestic market in China to sell its products. China wants the expertise, the manufacturing power, and the or know-how, and the foreign direct investment that Japan has to offer. So not only do they need each other, but frankly, the world needs a peaceful North Asia. And so they both have a lot at stake. They also have to resolve a lot of sticky issues, like sort of joint claims on oil rights in the East China Sea. There's a lot of friction between these two countries. There were anti-Japanese riots in 2005 in China. There was a survey that our reporter Sebastian Moffat wrote about in the journal this week that showed that warm feelings towards China are held by just 34% of Japanese, and it's down from almost 80% in 1980. So you can see the direction of sentiment.
Well, and how much, too, is this a PR move? We understand that the Chinese leader went jogging in a Tokyo park in a running outfit with a Beijing 2008 Olympics logo. I mean, how much is this reaching out ahead of the 2008 Olympics, part of putting some of its controversy behind China?
Well, he's really out there sort of offering a commercial for the Beijing Olympics, and he knows that the world media is going to be watching him. A lot of this is stagecraft. These things are incredibly orchestrated, particularly in a place like Japan, where you have a fairly regimented schedule when there are state visits. And mind you, things like China announcing that it was very keen to participate in a new carbon emissions framework when the Kyoto Protocol expires in a few years, even that is stagecraft. It suggests kind of a deep concern, abiding concern for the environment. when in fact it's all about trade and all about business. China sells carbon credits to big polluters like the United States and Japan and Europe, and so it wants new emission standards to maintain that big business of selling these carbon credits.
And finally, John, you know, just in a few sentences, your thoughts on what if, you know, Japan and China really forge a true friendship and alliance?
That's the positive possible outcome for everyone. Whether or not they are friends, that's probably quite some time into the future, simply because history and in the 20th century was so stark between the two, Japan an occupying power of China. But what we probably can hope for is that there's an abiding and growing commercial connection between these two countries. And that is simply going to produce additional turbo power for the engines at the front of the global economy. We want these two countries to have a successful business relationship because everybody in the world benefits from that.
John Bussey, editor for the Wall Street Journal Asia, speaking to us from Hong Kong about the Chinese premier's visit to Japan today. John, thanks so much.
You bet.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, what Legos, plastic ducks, and Nike sneakers tell us about the health of the world's oceans. And from Raging Bull to The Departed, She Made the Cut, Martin Scorsese's editor, Thelman Schoonmaker. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, Eddie Palmieri. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Imagine a swath of land stretching from, say, here in Boston to Portland, Maine, with homes on both sides of the road in ruins. Or the same scene on a trip from Los Angeles up to Santa Barbara in California. In Louisiana, people don't have to imagine. That's the destruction they still see when driving from the Louis Armstrong International Airport in New Orleans to the mouth of the Mississippi River. 90 miles of homes destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. It's the image that James O'Byrne and Mark Schlefstein want to leave in the minds of members of Congress, the media, everyone. They're reporters at the Times-Picayune. That's the New Orleans newspaper that won two Pulitzer Prizes for covering Hurricane Katrina, even as employees were displaced. They join us in the studio now. And Mark Schlefstein, let's start with you. You're the environmental reporter who co-wrote a series of articles that predicted the damage a hurricane like Katrina would do to New Orleans 3 years before the storm hit. You and James both lost your homes in the Lakeview area of town. How is New Orleans doing now?
We are hurting. The community is hurting quite a bit. And there are a lot of things going on there that need to be fixed. Everything from getting enough federal aid in there to rebuild the levees properly to making sure that the federal and state programs aimed at bringing people back and getting their houses back up are operating. What we are seeing now is that there's a huge amount of work that's going on by the Corps of Engineers to rebuild levees to where they should have been before Katrina, and they're also working on plans to raise them higher so that we will have a much better levee system, a lot better protection.
One of the things that we do at the newspaper, several of us, is whenever people come to town from various groups or just as individuals, we give them what we call misery tours. And universally, the experience that people have when they go on these misery tours is they cannot fathom how big it is and how bad off it still is 21 months after the storm.
What about the people who are there, you know, the psychology of the city? First of all, we read that there's a crime wave occurring, not as much targeting tourists, but, you know, for people who live there. And then we remember the, you know, psychological impact of this. We remember the story of the Times-Picayune photographer John McCusker, who led police on a car chase through the city. He begged the police to kill him when they caught up with him. He's charged with battery and flight from a police officer. He said, in January, he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. I would imagine people are still off kilter.
It's a tough place to live. One of the things that I've started to notice among my own staff, because if your house is significantly damaged, it's so hard to find contractors and so hard to get work done. And so now we're 21 months from the storm, and I don't know anyone who had significant damage to their house who's back in their house yet. So they're still working on their houses. They're living in a trailer in front of their house. They're living on the second floor, and the first floor is being worked on. They're tired. They're really worn out. And it is a place that, for those who live there, it just wears on you after a while. And, you know, usually the brain has a lot of ability to heal from trauma if it's not constantly reminded of the trauma. But in New Orleans, you can't drive anywhere without being reminded of the trauma. And that's one of the difficulties of living there, is that if you go anywhere off of the narrow area along the river where the tourists are, and you go out into the city, you're going to run into signs of devastation and loss and be reminded of all the things that have happened there. So it is psychologically a tough place to live, and people do struggle with it.
In terms of the crime, what we're seeing right now is before Katrina, there were a lot of, you know, drug-related sort of activity going on in different communities and different neighborhoods. Well, now all those neighborhoods are gone. And so you've got all of these bad guys who are fighting over their territory, their new territories, and that's a real problem. But so far, it really has been, you know, bad guy on bad guy in most instances.
Tell us a couple of things that we might not think of that makes New Orleans so different from the rest of the country right now.
On Easter Sunday, I was taking someone on a disaster tour, and I was standing on the empty lot that used to be my house where we lived for... My wife and I lived for 12 years and raised our two kids. And I had seen a picture earlier of the street, and it was a tranquil neighborhood with well-trimmed lawns and beautiful trees. And now I was standing in this sort of gray neighborhood where across the street from where I used to live, there was a big backhoe with a claw on it tearing down a house of one of my neighbors that used to live on my street. And basically no one living on my street 21 months after the storm, the street that I lived on for so long. And as I looked across the empty lots, I thought to myself, you know, it's starting to look better here. And when I take people on tours and say that, they look at me like I'm insane. How can you say it's starting to look better here? But it looked worse 20 months ago.
Right.
It's just, it's a place where an empty lot, a demolition of a house, is actually a sign of hope and progress. It would be inaccurate, though, to say that all of New Orleans is like that. It is indeed a place that is, it's a tale of two cities. If you come to New Orleans to do the things that tourists do when they come to New Orleans right now, you'll have a great time. The French Quarter is up and running. It was virtually unaffected by the storm. You can go to the Garden District and tour homes. You can eat at some of the best restaurants in the country. So we try to tell people this kind of mixed message, that it's a great place to visit. And if you're inclined to visit it, you'll have a great time. And if you have the courage to do so, we would love it if you would get off the island and go see what happened to the place where people live.
Well, and you know, James was saying how the block looked good, even though to other people it looked devastated. And I'm reminded, Susan Feeney of NPR apparently blogged about you, saying that you used to mow the lawn of your old destroyed home in Lakeview every weekend. You've since moved, and now your son has taken over mowing the lawn. Why mow the lawn of an area where there's no house?
Well, because on my street there are one or two houses where people are living, and you know, I still own the house, and you know, no matter what the shape is, I still have a responsibility to keep it up.
Sort of pride of place.
Right.
Did you ever think, you know, before Katrina, gee, I'm a reporter, you know, this is what I do, but I'm going to end up being an emissary for my city. I'm going to be a travel bureau. I'm going to try to get tourists to come to this city. And, in fact, even though your trip around the country now is to talk to people about New Orleans and being reporters, you're also, in some cases, including here in Boston, doing some fundraising for people who work for the paper.
It's a different role for us altogether, but we, as a newspaper, we're comfortable with the position that New Orleans should survive. And what emanates from that is a desire to educate people about what's going on there, about what has been done and what has not been done, about the degree to which the federal effort at recovery matches the federal acknowledgement of responsibility, and that's kind of what our role has become. It is our heartfelt belief that New Orleans deserves to survive and to thrive and to be rebuilt.
One of the ironies for me is that before Katrina, I spent a lot of time attempting to get news people to come to New Orleans to look at some of the problems and the potential danger resulting from the levees being too low and also coastal restoration issues. I unfortunately have some experience in doing this. I was not successful in getting people to wake up, though.
That's Mark Schlefstein, environmental reporter at the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. James O'Byrne is the feature editor. They are visiting here in the Boston area and have spoken to Congress about the problems of their hometown. Thank you both for speaking to us.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Still to come before we go, jazz great Eddie Palmieri. You're listening to Here and Now. Name some things you might find at your corner convenience store. Bread, milk, magazines, and penicillin. Many small stores in immigrant communities are selling medications, including antibiotics, and that has some doctors concerned. Here Now's health and science reporter Alan Cockle broke this story for our parent station, WBUR, here in Boston, and he's here to tell us more. Alan, who's buying these antibiotics?
It's mainly immigrants, and they're doing what they're accustomed to doing in much of the developing world. You don't need a prescription to buy what to us are prescription-only meds. So they're coming to this country, and the stores, the little stores that cater to them, are continuing to make those sorts of things available.
Right. Can you give us an example of what someone might be taking these medicines for?
Well, in some ways, the most interesting class of drugs that's being sold is antibiotics. In my reporting, I found people who said, no, use them for sores, for cavities in the teeth, for strep throat, which I think often means a sore throat, because obviously lots of sore throats, most sore throats are not strep throat. Let me play a bit of an interview with a woman who was buying antibiotics in a local Haitian store for sore throat, she said, but also she was taking it monthly after her period.
They call it ampicillin. You use it for strep throat, you use it for some minor infection. And after my period, too, that I used to use it to, you know, clean yourself as a female.
Well, we'll talk about what the medical profession thinks of this, but first, how common is this?
There's good reason to believe it's really common. There was a study in New York City in a Hispanic neighborhood that surveyed 34 stores. All of them sold antibiotics. There was a study in South Carolina that found a huge proportion of a Mexican migrant worker population was using antibiotics without prescription. And of the people who were buying them in the United States or obtaining them in the United States, which was about 1 in 5, almost all of them were buying them in U.S. stores.
Now, you have been going into stores here in the Boston area, and it's remarkable. I mean, many of the storekeepers spoke very honestly with you about this.
Some of the storekeepers did. I went in, presented my card to the guy, explained what I was doing, and he started sort of showing me what was on the shelves.
Mm-hmm. What are these stores like, though? I mean, is this the CVS or, you know, a chain store?
No, they tend to be these little convenience stores, but people tend to call bodegas. So they've got some fresh produce. They've got products, you know, from the home country. They've got bread, and they've got a little shelf of medicines, a lot of, you know, vitamins and things. And then they often have these antibiotics stashed away behind the counter.
What kinds of antibiotics?
Big range. The most common thing we were offered in our informal survey was ampicillin. Tetracycline was also common. A drug called amantadine, which is an antiviral used to treat flu. And there's a long list. Metronidazole, chloramphenicol, these are other antibiotics.
You know, I'm smiling because one of the themes on the recent Sopranos was some low-level thugs trying to push the sale of expired drugs. I mean, what are the safety concerns about these drugs?
Well, that's one potential concern, and doctors expressed others. They have patients who are treating themselves. They don't know what they're on. There's the potential for drug interactions. And then at the population level, there's this potential for antibiotic resistance. Here's Dr. Arch Manus. He's the fellow I mentioned who did the study in South Carolina.
We know that there would be millions of times that this would happen just to treat things like colds. But on top of that, even when they get the antibiotics, they're not getting them in quantities that would be appropriate anyway. They may take 2 or 3 pills. I think that we have to change these behaviors. Otherwise, we're going to start seeing potentially a situation in the United States that's similar to Latin American countries where we have much higher resistance rates.
And that's a key point where he says people are taking 1 or 2 pills. And that's what we found in many, many cases is when we would go into the stores and my translator would say, what do you have for a sore throat? They would say, well, take this. And they would offer 1 or 2 capsules of ampicillin. So, you know, that's one thing we know about how to create antibiotic resistance is don't finish your antibiotics. Don't do the full course. Mm-hmm. So even if people were using them appropriately, they're not taking enough to be effective.
Well, what did public health officials say to you about this?
It's a mix. I talked to a lot of doctors who work closely with immigrant populations, and many of them say, yes, we know this happens. Nobody really knows how much. And then I also, this is interesting, talked to a lot of doctors and public health people who had never heard of it. And officials, the FDA and the state officials here say, although it's illegal, it's a really tough thing to enforce because they're small stores and there's no single huge source that you could crack down on.
Here Now's health and science reporter Alan Cockle. Alan, thanks for continuing to follow this story for us.
Thank you.
Okay, just ahead, the music of Eddie Palmieri. This is Here Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the 50 years that Eddie Palmieri has been playing, he's made records that sound like this. And this. And now this. Never a purist, Eddie Palmieri's music fuses Latin rhythms with modern jazz, like this classic Eddie Harris tune, Listen Here. With 33 albums and 8 Grammy Awards under his belt, Eddie Palmieri is being honored by Harvard University here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he's joining us now to talk about music, collaboration, and more. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Robin. Thank you.
We want to play more from your most recent CD, Listen Here. But first, the solo that we just heard is from the wonderful but sadly late saxophonist Michael Brecker, who passed away in January, way too young, in his 50s.
Yes, Michael, we've known each other for quite a while, and Randy Brecker also.
His brother, yeah. What will you miss most about Michael's playing?
Oh, he's just one of the most amazing tenor saxophonists that ever picked up that horn, in my opinion. He's going to be such an empty vacuum without him. And there was a great story that Randy was explaining. They were doing a recording, and the music was quite difficult. That they had sent Randy in advance, but Mike hadn't seen them. He was on tour. And when he arrived to the studio, then it came to a part that it was a solo for Michael Brecker. Mm. And he took this incredible solo. You know. And when the solo was over, the gentleman in charge told Randy, "Now you follow that." You know, follow that, and Randy looked at that. No, you follow that. No one could follow that. I mean, it was there was the word that you take the solo before Michael's solo,
not the solo after.
No, you don't follow him. He was a great, great player. He's going to be really, really missed.
Well, now Eddie Palmieri, a new collaboration for you with your longtime trumpeter Brian Lynch. I want to listen to a little more of this. This is Guajir à Dubois from your new CD. This is your first collaboration as a band leader since you worked with vibraphonist Cal Jader in the 60s. But you're known as, you know, a strong band leader. So how was it like for you to, you know, share that role maybe?
Well, what happened was I believed that I was going to be an invited guest. Okay, that's all. It was going to be a Brian Lynch album. Then Brian, you know, came over to the house, and we started to collaborate with about 4 compositions on the CD with him. And they played on 7, and the next thing I know, we're in Europe, and when he shows me how it's going to be released, it's at the Brian Lynch, Eddie Palmieri project. And I looked at him and said, I can't believe it. You know, I really just came as an invited guest, but, you know, we said fine, and he's with me with 20 years we've been traveling together, so whatever I could do to help his project.
So you were perfectly happy to give up the power of band leader. You didn't know you were band leader until they named it.
And the thing was then we both won a Grammy.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're not playing like a drummer, you know, having this sort of percussive style. And there are a lot of musicians who were drummers and they go on to play other instruments and, you know, that bring that percussiveness with them. But this was when you started this in, what, 55? At the time, it was considered kind of revolutionary. Why do you play like that?
Well, I did play timbales for a while, and the saxophonist Donald Harrison on the road once was listening to one of the recordings. He goes, "Man, you know, you solo like a drummer, you know? And it's the percussiveness in me, and I utilize it within our structure of our music. You know, it's based on the most incredible, you know, complicated rhythmical patterns, you know, for me in the world, really, the Latin rhythmical patterns. And to get in there with the percussion players that we use on congas and bongo and and timbales, in and out of that, I adopted my own personal style, which is like the signature that I have developed in my playing.
You play some classic bebop as well. I want to listen to the Horace Silver tune, Nika's Dream. It features, among others, a violinist, Regina Carter.
Yes.
Violins, I mean, it's not that unusual, but it's still, it's a little bit unusual.
Well, what happened was that the gentleman called Richard Seidel co-produced it with me. He had a dear friend of my son, Eddie, and he asked these different artists if they would like to be on the CD with us. And one of them was Regina Carter. She said yes. Nicholas Payton, he's on trumpet on this track here. And there's where Michael Brecker, you know, came in, and Christy McBride, David Sanchez, and she was one of the invited guest artists that came down.
Huh. Yeah, I want to ask you
and
this.
She can play.
Oh, she can play.
Because she not only could play her violin, but she had played with Latin orchestras, so she wasn't uncomfortable at all.
Right. We think she just won a MacArthur grant, a genius grant.
Yes, she did.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to ask you, Eddie Palmieri, Latin influences, you know, common in jazz. But you were making records back when there were very few Puerto Rican artists playing. When you were growing up, what were your influences?
Well, I was born in New York, and there, then the big bands were happening. The Machito Orchestra, Machito and his Afro-Cubans, which started in 1939 and took all of the 40s and the 50s, when the time of the Mambo, then the Cha-Cha-Cha came in. Then Tito Puente, my brother was playing with him when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And then another orchestra called Tito Rodriguez. And these were the orchestras that I was listening to as I was growing up. And at the same time, I always wanted to be a dance orchestra leader. You know, I really got into me to have my own band. I enjoyed seeing the people dance. And by 1961, I was able to form the orchestra.
Huh. Well, Eddie Palmieri, it's been a delight to talk to you. And how does it feel to be honored by Harvard?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. And I was here last month, and we did 2 days with the students. And now I'll be here till Sunday. And tomorrow we expect Brian Lynch to come in, and we'll all be working with the students and that. And then we have the concert on Saturday.
You're actually working with the students?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know what they're going to say? Have you ever heard the saying? They're going to say, Eddie Palmieri must be the bus driver because he took those Harvard students to school. We're going to leave you with Miraflores from Eddie's new CD, Listen Here. For more on the music, the career of Eddie Palmieri, go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Ram. Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer, our web producer, Ken George. Our interns are Austin Mayfield and Emily Reddy. And today we want to especially thank our intern and Iraqi, Huda Ahmed, for her help in our Iraq reporting. Our managing editor, Chris Ballman, the senior producer of Here and Now, Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.